friends and colleagues, and welcome to episode 87 of Dermasphere, the podcast by dermatologists, for dermatologists, and for the dermatologically curious. I am one of your hosts. My name is Luke Johnson. I'm a pediatric dermatologist and general dermatologist with the University of Utah. And joining me, of course, is...
This is Michelle Tarbox. I'm an associate professor of dermatology and dermatopathology at Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in beautiful, sunny Lubbock, Texas. And guess what, Luke?
What, Michelle?
We have the extreme privilege of having a fantastic authority on the field of cutaneous T-cell lymphoma, Dr. Martin Vermeer, who is a lead author and a professor of clinical dermatology at Leiden University Medical Center. And we're very excited to have him on to help us understand better the advances that are being made and how we take care of patients with cutaneous T-cell lymphoma.
So Dr. Vermeer, thank you for joining us. Do you want to start by introducing yourself?
Yes, so my name is Martin Vermeer. I'm a dermatologist and head of the department of the dermatology department here at Leiden University. And I've been working on cutaneous lymphomas already for quite a long time. And maybe I could now introduce a little bit about cutaneous lymphomas, because that will be the subject that we will be talking about. And it's not that familiar, of course, to everyone. In fact, CTCL, or cutaneous T-cell lymphomas, and that's what we'll be focusing on today, is a collection of rare non-Hodgkin lymphomas that primarily present in the skin. And the most common subtype of CTCL would be mycosis fungoides, and then there's also Sézary syndrome. That is one of the best studied subtypes of this disease.
And my memory from residency is that Sézary syndrome is like super bad CTCL when it really gets into the blood and people do poorly. Is that generally correct?
That's generally correct. So it's rare and it's an aggressive type of CTCL, and it's typically characterized by an erythrodermic skin, so red skin from head to toe, lymphadenopathy, and leukemic involvement. And these patients have a very poor prognosis. And that's in contrast to patients with mycosis fungoides, early stages of disease, patches and plaques, that normally have a quite a good life expectancy. However, it should be noted that a number of these patients with early stage MF, they will progress to more advanced stages of disease, and then the prognosis worsens.
I'm so grateful that you're going to be on this podcast with us. When I was in my training up in the Cleveland Clinic, because it's the northern climes and it's overcast a lot of the time, you know, we saw a lot more cutaneous T-cell lymphoma than I do down in beautiful, sunny Lubbock, Texas, but the disease remains quite a significant impact on patients' lives that have it. And there have been a lot of developments in how we stage and monitor this condition over the past several years and up to a decade. Can you kind of tell us a little bit about how people are using more of the emerging technologies to help manage these patients and stage them?
Well, you're right. There has been a lot of development in recent years, both in the novel therapies that have become available, but also with novel techniques that we now use to monitor or detect disease, and in particular, identify blood involvement. And that has been sort of the subject of some of the recent studies that we have been performing at our institute, but in particular also in collaboration with our colleagues in other EURTC centers in Europe.
That's awesome. I think those collaborative projects can develop so much more information and better understanding of these conditions. Your paper was fascinating, and its foundation is based in part on flow cytometry. I know a lot of practicing dermatologists don't necessarily have at their fingertips a great understanding of how that technology works. Could you explain to us in sort of lay dermatologic terms how that technology can be used?
Well, I can certainly give it a try. So we all know skin biopsies. We love skin biopsies because that way we can see how many tumor cells are present in skin and what they look like. In addition to morphology, we use immunohistochemistry. And for that immunohistochemistry, the essential tool there is our antibodies directed against often membrane-bound proteins expressed by cells. Now, flow cytometry, in a way, is very similar. You could say it's the immunohistochemistry of blood. What you do is you take blood from a patient, then after incubation with your antibodies directed often against the same antigens, coupled to a fluorochrome, are let through a very tiny capillary. And when they are in this capillary, they are hit by a laser, and if the fluorochrome is hit, it emits a signal. This is detected by a transponder, and then it goes into a computer. So it tells you basically the proteins that are expressed by the cells that are present in the blood. And combined with the size of the cells and the complexity of the cells, the readout finally is that you know the number of cells expressing a particular combination of membrane-bound proteins. I hope I've explained it sufficiently. It's a little bit complicated, but you typically, as an answer, your readout from this technique would be, we see in the blood an atypical population, the number is around 15%, and these are cells are CD4 positive, they are CD7 negative, and CD26 negative, and they do express PD-1, for example.
That's awesome.
Blood, lasers, and computers. It seems like we should all be turning into Marvel superheroes with this kind of technology.
I was thinking it's like laser tag for cells, where you can kind of like, it's sort of like quantitative laser tag for cells, where you can kind of figure out the populations. And that's what produces those scatter plots that we see in the literature, where they have the different populations outlined.
That's correct.
So, Dr. Vermeer, you and a few co-authors recently published this paper about flow cytometry updates, which I think we'd like to talk about today. It was published in the British Journal of Dermatology. The title is Flow Cytometry for the Assessment of Blood Tumor Burden in Cutaneous T-Cell Lymphoma Toward a Standardized Approach. You are the first author. Senior author is listed as Sean Whitaker. And the funding sources is, for full disclosure, this work was supported by Kaowa Kirin. According to the internet, that's a Japanese pharma group that develops innovative specialty drugs. So what's new with flow cytometry these days? How should we be using it?
That's a good question. The flow cytometry has been around for quite a long time, and it has been more and more acknowledged that flow cytometry offers the most objective tool to measure blood involvement. Previously, a lot of manual counts were performed looking at morphology, but this has more or less has become the technique of the past. There's much more focus now on flow cytometry. And recent years, the use of flow cytometry has expanded a lot, in particular because we are not using one laser, but multiple lasers. And it's now possible using advanced analytical tools and better computer analysis tools, software, to use this flow cytometry to quantify accurately the number of tumor cells in the blood. And this, of course, offers a number of advantages when you're treating patients, because it now becomes possible to detect early stages of disease because the technique has become much more sensitive. It will be possible to identify if particular proteins are present that can be used as a therapeutic target, so it might guide your treatment approach. It will also be something that you can use to measure your therapeutic response. And there's one very exciting area, I think, that is those patients that are given a stem cell transplantation. You can use flow cytometry to monitor for minimal residual disease. So there are a number of advantages using this technique in the diagnostic phase, therapeutic phase, and monitoring phase.
To me, it's almost like having a Swan-Ganz catheter versus like a blood pressure cuff when you're talking about the difference between the flow cytometry and traditional histology. And you know, this is coming from a dermatopathologist who, of course, I'm quite fond of immunohistochemistry and these things, but I realize the limitations that it has and the fact that we're also dealing sometimes with sample artifact when you're talking about a rash. And that problem is compounded when we have people who might be less knowledgeable in the field of dermatology performing the biopsies. So I think that is a realistic limitation of tissue-specific checking, and I think something that flow cytometry can help partially address.
But there's hope for the dermatopathologist here, because we are always looking at, using flow cytometry, you are looking at the tumor cell compartment in the blood. And I strongly believe you should combine it with skin biopsies so that you know how your skin cells are behaving in tissue as well. And we do see discrepancies here, and they might be important in your therapeutic approach. So there you go.
That's good news for us dermatopathologists.
So the paper, I think, suggests that there's fairly good consensus among experts that everybody with any stage of CTCL should have flow cytometry. Did I read that correctly, Dr. Vermeer?
I think there's very strong consensus that flow cytometry is definitely needed in advanced stages of disease. Patients that have rapid progression of disease, patients that are erythrodermic, patients that develop lymph nodes, patients that have generalized skin lesions, in particular if there are skin tumors or if they have high serum LDH, I think you definitely need flow cytometry to see if something is present in the blood. In those patients that present with limited patch or plaque stage mycosis fungoides, so less than 10% of your skin, it might be possible using very sensitive techniques to detect a few tumor cells, which makes sense because these patients have multiple plaques and probably the tumor cells do not crawl through the skin from one skin area to the other. They will have a blood phase where they circulate. But how important that is in your therapeutic management, I'm not so sure. It could be that in those patients, that the small number of patients that do progress to more advanced stages of disease could be picked up in an early phase using this technique. And that's one of the holy grails, I would say, in the novel flow cytometry approaches that we are now developing.
That's you mentioned awesome. A few red flags that would make you want to make sure to use flow cytometry for patients. You mentioned a couple others in the article as well. I just want to mention for our readers. So people with leukocytosis or intractable pruritus or lack of response to treatment, you and your co-authors also called out as being good candidates for flow cytometry. So what's the future look like? What are the challenges? What are smart people like you working on now?
The challenges are that we would like to develop a tool that will, the ultimate flow cytometry test would allow us to have a optimal combination of antibodies that in a standardized, effective, and clinically validated protocol would always accurately identify and quantify the number of circulating tumor cells. And to be honest, we are not there yet. We do know some cell surface proteins that are often lost by tumor cells, including CD7 and CD26. Those two are the most well known. And in previous blood staging classifications that have been proposed, loss of CD7 and CD26 have a sort of a very important place. But it's also acknowledged now that loss of CD7 and 26 is also observed in reactive CD4 positive cells. And this makes it very complicated. And not all your tumor cells will lose CD26 or CD7. So there is extensive intrapatient heterogeneity combined with changes in your reactive cells that make it, I think, impossible to quantify number of circulating tumor cells using only those two markers. Fortunately, new markers are on the horizon, including the killer cell immunoglobulin-like receptor, CD158K, CCR4, PD-1, and also others, just to make the point that by combining your CD4 staining with a number of other stainings, it might be possible to quantify them in a good way. And in fact, we do have a recent publication where we use the so-called Euroflow protocols that have a very rigorous approach to standardize all experimental procedures and using multiple stainings that we could identify in patients with Sézary syndrome that indeed there is extensive intra and interpatient heterogeneity that also changes over time, but we were able to identify all the tumor cells using this multi-staining protocol.
That's awesome. And that's something I try to explain to my residents when we're talking about how cancer changes and evolves, is that when you have a cell that has mutations, it's almost like having a machine that has a broken part. And as that machine's trying to work with the broken part, other parts get out of whack and more parts break. But if each machine is going to break potentially differently. So you develop different clones within the population that have different mutations. And this certainly happens here too.
And that's exactly what we saw. So in some patients that we followed over 3 or 4 years, we did see development of subclones, and we could identify them because we were using, I think that's an important new thing in this field, not one staining, but multiple staining. So we were combining the stainings in a very sort of intelligent way, we hope.
Yeah, there's complex immunophenotypes where you can kind of pick out certain populations of cells that may be more concerning for the development of significant systemic disease or might be a harbinger of a next stage for that patient. If that could be detected early, potential for early intervention increases, which is awesome.
That's spot on. That's precisely what we are doing now. So the first publication was just to show that using this technique, we have a much improved identification and quantification of the tumor cells. Now in a longitudinal study that is being performed in 14 different centers in Europe, we are doing just that.
That's amazing.
Well, we will look forward
to show
to
you
those
the power of well. To show you the power of collaboration. Within half a year, within 6 months, we have now data on more than 70 patients, and we are expanding more and more in the next 3 to 4 years.
That's an amazing undertaking and such a development in this field. I'm also so impressed that you are doing all of this, of course, in a second or third language. Are you Dutch?
Yes.
So bedankt, I think, did I say that right? Yes. Thank you for being an amazing person and for discussing this with such fluency in what is probably a second or third language. I've always been so impressed with your country in general because so many people are multilingual.
Yeah, we are so small. We have to be multilingual because no one else speaks Dutch.
Except for Michelle, apparently. There's no limit.
Yeah, apart from Michelle. Thank you for that.
Well, Dr. Vermeer, thanks so much for joining us today. If people want to learn more about you or your research, would you direct them to anywhere in particular?
We do have a website, of course. Our department has a website, or people can send me a mail. That would be absolutely fine. And I'd be very happy to answer any questions that people have.
Excellent. Well, we really appreciate you being here today, and we'll look forward to this larger study you mentioned.
Thank you.
Thank you.
For the rest of the episode today, I want to talk about some of the medicines that have recently been approved in the world of dermatology. We've got a lot of approvals that have recently gone through, and I think it would be fun to talk about some of the trials that got those medicines approved so that listeners, you will feel like you know about them so that you can use them as appropriate or avoid them if you feel like that would be the most appropriate. And we also talked about this at our University of Utah Department of Dermatology in our journal club, which the residents run for the most part. And we've got one of those residents with us today to discuss one of those medicines. So welcome, Dr. Nicole Ufkus. Thanks for joining us.
Woo! Thanks for having me.
So you're one of the residents here at the University of Utah, a recent second year, and you would like to talk to us about ruxolitinib cream for vitiligo. And you're recording out of a room at the VA somewhere, so we will forgive any audio issues.
Yes, hopefully this is coming through not too loud, not too quiet, because God only knows. But yes. So we're talking about ruxolitinib as a treatment of vitiligo. There was a 2020 study published in The Lancet. It was funded by Incyte. And the primary purpose of it was to investigate the therapeutic potential of ruxolitinib cream in patients with vitiligo and to report the efficacy and safety results after 52 weeks of treatment. So this was a randomized, double-blind, phase 2 study that was completed across 26 hospitals. It involved 157 adult patients who had vitiligo involving at least 0.5% of facial body surface area and at least 3% of non-facial body surface area. So the primary endpoint that the study was investigating was 50% improvement in the facial vitiligo area scoring index at week 24. And then there were numerous secondary endpoints, one being 50% or higher improvement from baseline in total vitiligo area scoring index by week 52. So a little bit about study design. It had three parts and was carried out over 156 weeks total. So in the first part, participants were randomly assigned into the vehicle or control group, applying the vehicle cream twice daily, and then four ruxolitinib cream groups. So 1.5% daily, 1.5% twice daily, 0.5% daily, or 0.15% daily. And then in the second part, which started at week 24, patients in the control group and then in the lowest potency ruxolitinib cream group who did not achieve the facial vitiligo area scoring index goal were then randomly allocated into one of the three higher percentage ruxolitinib groups until week 52. And then the patients that had already been in the ruxolitinib cream groups, they just continued on their destined path for an additional 28 weeks of treatment using the ruxolitinib cream. And then after week 52, then they opened it up as a third open label part of the study where everybody got to use the ruxolitinib cream 1.5% twice daily for 104 weeks, along with discretional phototherapy. So what they found was that the patients who received the 1.5% daily cream or the BID cream achieved the primary endpoint of 50% improvement in the facial vitiligo area scoring index at week 24, and that the highest dose of the 1.5% BID and daily showed the most significant improvement. And then this improvement was seen continually after 52 weeks of using the cream. The side effects of using the ruxolitinib cream overall was pretty well tolerated. The most common side effect was itch at the site. And then also acne was more common in the ruxolitinib cream versus the vehicle. So the limitations of the study, it didn't include a ton of young adults. If you, say 20 to 30 years old being young adults, mean age was 48 years. So a little bit of an older group. Most patients also had fairer skin types. It's about 64% were types 1 to 3 and 9% were types 5 to 6. But, they did include all skin types. So at least they were trying. So the implications, this was the first large randomized study to report the efficacy of a targeted immunomodulatory agent in vitiligo. They showed that this ruxolitinib may be an effective option for treatment of vitiligo. And indeed, the reason for this talk is that it is now FDA approved for not only atopic derm, but non-segmental vitiligo for people 12 years and older. And the instructions are to apply twice a day to all affected areas, up to 10% of body surface area, with the plan for at least 24 weeks of improvement from the treatment. So that is kind of the gist of that article.
Very cool. I thought it was a great article, and I think you covered that very well. There were some like well-made points and some basic learning things that I think are good to kind of talk about in these kinds of trials. One of them is, what is a phase 2 trial, right? So phase 1 trials, where you usually start research, these are typically smaller. They're aimed at figuring out the safety of the drug, side effects, and dosing, but their priority is safety. So you'll see that in the title usually of phase 1 trial. Phase 2 trials are typically going to be designed to look at dosing requirements and efficacy, and sometimes they're separated out that way. So a 2A trial is often dosing requirements, and a 2B is usually more efficacy, which is what some of these aims are. And then, of course, the phase 3 is going to be the large studies that get the medications approved, and those are going to look at both efficacy and safety. And then phase 4 studies happen after the drug's already been released and licensed. So those are good things, I think, to understand how all of that works. I think that a very pimpable thing out of, looking at this is what the common side effects are. And, I think that Janice kinase inhibitors and topically applied in acne is going to be a potential test question for people. I think that also the pathophysiology of vitiligo and the cytokines involved are pimpable content. So we know that it's CD8 T cells that like to go beat up on the melanocytes in vitiligo, and that's mediated by interferon gamma through the chemokines that have the CXC motif, so CXCL9 and 10. And one of the cool things in the study is they even showed that through treatment of the vitiligo, the CXCL10 levels actually decreased measurably in the serum. So I thought that was kind of fascinating and also a bit pimpable. Did you have any other pimpable things you wanted to bring forward, Luke?
Well, a couple things that I thought were interesting, I'm not sure whether or not they're pimpable or not, was that this was a fairly severe population. Their median disease duration was 14 years. So quite severe, but also this is optimistic, right? Even if you have had depigmentation for over 10 years, perhaps there's something out there that can help get it back. So that's cool. They point out that most patients had longstanding and extensive disease, had received previous treatment. So this was a difficult to treat population. The medicine worked all right. I wouldn't say it was dramatic. And also they kind of buried it in the text somewhere, but is this actually any better than existing treatments? They point out that there haven't been a lot of historic studies on vitiligo. There's been some stuff on topical steroids, some stuff on calcineurin inhibitors, but they've been pretty small trials. But their outcomes were kind of roughly similar to this one, as far as I could tell. So I think that this ruxolitinib stuff probably works about as well as topical steroids, about as well as calcineurin inhibitors, about as well as phototherapy, probably. I suspect that these things are synergistic to some degree. And probably the reason that calcineurin inhibitors and topical steroids haven't been approved for vitiligo is no pharmaceutical company has felt incentivized to run those trials because, you know, a lot of those are generic and stuff like that. So I don't think this is going to be the first thing I reach for, even though it's exciting that it's the first therapy approved for vitiligo. And I think its approval has brought attention to the disease and has brought more patients to my office saying, you know, I've had this for years and I now know that there's an approved treatment. It might feel weird to say to them, well, actually, these other treatments probably work all right. Have you given these a good try? And so mostly due to the expense. So this stuff is called Opzelura. That's brand name, and it's $2,000 for a 60-gram tube, which is a lot of money. Yes. Definitely more than tacrolimus or triamcinolone or something like that. It doesn't have the striae potential that topical steroids do, but with judicious use, hopefully you can mitigate that issue. Those are my thoughts about it.
I thought this was another also good highlight of how a phase two trial is typically designed. So there's multiple treatment arms with different dosing regimens because they're looking for what is the kind of lowest efficacious dose typically. And they also had something that they look for in these trials, which is a dose response, in that patients that had higher exposure to the medication generally did better. So that's usually an indicator that that medication is successfully therapeutic for the aim of the study. So I thought it was a nicely designed study as well. And, you know, nice to have a new option for patients who have vitiligo. I think it's also helping us understand the pathogenesis of the condition a bit better.
And I think most of us really down there in the trenches, as we say, know that we can get these topical JAK inhibitors compounded through various specialty pharmacies for way, way cheaper than $2,000 for 60 grams. So you could probably get ruxolitinib 2% cream compounded for like $200 for a 30-gram tube or something like that. So also an option, of course, my goal is for the patient to pay the least amount possible. But also as doctors, we should also be good stewards of the healthcare system and the healthcare dollars that we as a society spend. Dr. Ufkas, thanks for joining us and reviewing that article. Anything else you would like to call attention to?
No, I think we hit it all. I guess I will just add kind of going what you were saying, Luke, about the previous, you know, the therapies we know work that aren't technically, you know, FDA approved. It kind of made me think, I listened to the one of the past episodes where Dr. Feldman did his adherence talk, which I thought he was a total hoot. And then when reviewing this article for Journal Club, I kept thinking kind of what he kept saying of, do the therapies we have actually work just as good if people actually just did what they were told? That was kind of something that was going through my mind reading this article as well. But I agree, it's still an exciting new medicine to have. So.
All right. Well, thanks so much. We will catch you next time.
All right. Thanks. Talk to you later.
Thank you.
Another new medicine that was approved recently is baricitinib for alopecia areata. And I'm going to talk about that one. So this is an article out of the New England Journal called Two Phase 3 Trials of Baricitinib for Alopecia Areata. Authors include Brett King and Rodney Sinclair. So these were 1,200 adults, all of whom had a SALT score of 50 or more. And I didn't know what SALT score was until I looked into this. It turns out that French fries have a high SALT score.
You kill me, just like French fries.
SALT. I honestly forget what it stands for. But it's a marker of how severe somebody's alopecia areata is on their scalp. And it turns out it's very simple. Unlike the easy score, which is not easy, this one actually is easy. It's basically what percentage of their scalp hair is missing. So the scalp score ranges from 0, which means you have no hair loss, to 100, which means your scalp is completely bald. And then there are maps and stuff you can use to figure out sort of like based on this area of the scalp. There's like 50% on the side is missing. That's not actually like that percentage of the scalp, because the side of the scalp is like less percentage of the total hair, whatever. So if you're doing research, you know that stuff. But for our purposes, these patients all had SALT scores of 50 plus, meaning they were missing 50% or more of their scalp hair.
And the SALT is for severity of alopecia. The reason it's tool. So it's severity of alopecia tool. The reason it's hard to know what that is I feel like the L should be lowercase because it's the second letter of alopecia, but that's what it is. Severity of alopecia tool.
Thank you. Is it used only for alopecia areata, or can you use it for other forms of alopecia?
I think it's standardized for alopecia areata. I'm not sure that it's applied to other types of hair loss, but I'll check.
That was my impression as well, but yeah. Not being a hair researcher, I'm not sure. So
I'm
patients
a hair nerd,
in this
I'm
study, these 1,200 adults were placed on placebo and then or baricitinib at two different doses, 4 milligrams or 2 milligrams daily. This was monotherapy, so they weren't also doing topical steroids or ILK or anything like that. The goal was to have a SALT score of 20 or less. So that means 20% or less of your hair has been lost. And apparently that has previously been validated as a meaningful outcome, quote, for patients with alopecia areata. So at week 36, which is 9 months, so these things take a while, sort of like that vitiligo study with the ruxolitinib cream that we had just talked about. I think that also highlighted how long it takes, because they had outcomes at week 52, right, which is like a year. So after 9 months, this goal of a SALT score of 20 or less was achieved by 37% of patients on the 4 milligram dose, 20% of patients on the 2 milligram dose, and 5% with placebo. So definitely more in the baricitinib group, but sadly, it doesn't look as dramatic as some of the JAK inhibitor results have been with other diseases like atopic dermatitis. So 37% of people with a 4 milligram group got to SALT score of 20 or less. Adverse events were fairly mild, as we have noticed in other trials with JAK inhibitors, included acne, elevated CK, elevated lipids. And it's important to note that, again, kind of like this vitiligo trial we discussed, these patients were quite severe. So again, their SALT score was 50 plus. Their current alopecia episode had to last at least 6 months, and it was up to 8 years. On average, it was 4 years. So again, this gives hope to people who even had alopecia for years. We can get it back. Half of the patients had a SALT score of 95 to 100. So half of the patients had basically no hair left on their scalp. So this was a pretty severe group. They did point out that there was nobody with the, quote, diffuse pattern of alopecia areata. That was an exclusion criteria. And the adverse events were mild. So acne showed up in 6% of patients in the 4 milligram group, 5% of patients in the 2 milligram group, and then 1% in placebo. UTIs, urinary tract infections, were 5% and 8% in the baricitinib groups and only 1% in the placebo group. There was one myocardial infarction in a patient on the 2 milligrams of baricitinib who had, quote, risk factors for myocardial infarction. But we know from that old oral surveillance study that we discussed that JAK inhibitors perhaps increase one's risk of cardiovascular outcomes. So whether or not this one in particular was related is going to be tough to say. There was also one B-cell lymphoma that showed up in a 4 milligram patient. Again, whether or not that's related is tough to say. A lot of people had elevations in their LDL and their HDL. 25% had elevation in the LDL and 40% in the HDL. Don't know how clinically meaningful that is. Isn't HDL the good cholesterol anyway?
Yeah, it's supposed to be.
Yeah, but I think there have been studies that showed that medicines that just increase the number HDL don't actually affect outcomes. So
I think it's the stuff that you do that increases the HDL, like exercise and good diet and stuff.
And moderate alcohol intake. Not zero alcohol intake, moderate. We're tangential now. Don't Tito's and tan. There were some CBC abnormalities that showed up in these patients, but they all normalized. There were no VTEs, which we have potentially seen in other JAK inhibitors. There were no opportunistic infections. They pointed out there were no GI perforations, which I wasn't sure of the relevance of that. I haven't seen any GI perforation signals in the other JAK inhibitor stuff we've reviewed, but maybe it shows up in other specialty literature.
Condition, yeah.
So that's sort of the overall story of how it performed and the side effects. So decent, but not amazing, I would say, but probably better than a lot of the other stuff we've tried, especially that these patients have tried. Baricitinib, of course, is a JAK inhibitor. It inhibits JAK1 and JAK2. Those signaling pathways are used by interferon and interleukin-15, for example, which are thought to play a role in the pathogenesis of alopecia areata. For monitoring, like other JAK inhibitors, it's a little hazy. They say check CBC and LFTs at baseline and, quote, periodically. Check lipids at 12 weeks and then, quote, periodically. You should screen for hepatitis and tuberculosis before starting. And in our last episode, episode 86, we discussed recent CDC recommendations that people who are going to be immunosuppressed, adults, should get the shingles vaccine before they get immunosuppressed. Whether or not a JAK inhibitor truly counts as being immunosuppressed is potentially open to debate, but not in this study, but in other trials with JAK inhibitors, more people have gotten shingles. So I still think it makes a lot of sense to get people the Shingrix vaccine on that. So this is approved for alopecia areata, an age 18 plus as of June of 2022. The recommended dose is 2 milligrams, but you can go to 4 milligrams if you feel like it. For 30 days of the 4 milligram dose, it'll cost you $5,000.
That is expensive. So the gastrointestinal perforation thing, that's a thing that happens with biologics in patients who have RA. And it's been reported with IL-6 inhibitors, but there have been a few case reports of JAK inhibitor associated GI perforation, and they think it actually has to do with like downstream effects on IL-6 signaling. So that is new pimpable content there. So IL-6 and GI perforation in patients with RA, possibility for some participation with the Janus kinase inhibitors in that axis with IL-6.
So, ooh, and one other thing. Exciting. Oh, yeah, go ahead.
So SALT also stands for satisfaction and loyalty tracking, which is something they do at hotels. So that every time that I like hear SALT score, I have to like think, not that, the other thing.
Because of your other side gig in hospitality?
No, one of my friends did hospitality and I helped her study in college. So we had kind
Sounds like you picked up something as well.
I mean, I learned some things. She learned some things about dermatomes. It was fun.
Well, this is a fairly exciting new drug that addresses a need that has been poorly addressed by other medicines. But it's $5,000 for a month. And again, this is like stewards of the healthcare system type stuff. We as a society, I probably talked about this before, do a pretty good job of developing cool new drugs and then talking about how cool they are. We do not do a good job of discussing the costs and whether or not they're worth it. And I'm not somebody who has alopecia areata or alopecia universalis, so I can read the studies that say it affects their quality of life, but I can't feel it for myself. And so we could have these discussions about, is stuff like this worth it? Are the resources we're spending toward this worth it compared to the same amount of resources we could spend to do something else? We could have those discussions. Nobody seems to want to. But we could, so at least I see our role as at least mentioning it.
Mm-hmm. I think it's a hard thing for any doctor to like look at a patient that comes with a problem and says, you know, I'm suffering with this, and then to know that there's a potential solution, but that that solution has an opportunity cost that might be the treatment of a different condition that more people would agree is more morbid. Now, what an individual person suffering means is so unique to that individual person that making value judgments based off that is very, very difficult. And I think that's one of the reasons why no one wants to confront this, is that, you know, we have this question of just because we can, should we, right? Because we can treat this, should we? And it's an easy answer for things like ALL, right? Like, who cares how much the medicine costs? It's saving a 3-year-old's life. That's an easy thing to get people on board with, right? But for something that, while we as dermatologists know it has a significant effect on people's quality of life, like alopecia areata, and you know, even to a certain extent vitiligo, but more alopecia areata, we also know that in terms of danger to the person's rest of their life, we can't, you know, really put the same weight on it as we would a diagnosis like ALL or even a morbid medical diagnosis like psoriasis. Vitiligo, you could argue about, you know, the lack of protection from UV radiation and increased risk of carcinogenesis. But with alopecia areata, it's harder. And, you know, I'm a hair loss like nerd and I really care about my hair loss patients. I also know that I have hair loss patients who have severe alopecia areata who, have decided that that's just part of who they are, and they embrace that and they go on with their life and it doesn't impact them. And I have patients with alopecia areata who every day is about the fact that they don't have hair, you know? And it's one of those things that I think is a very difficult decision for one, a physician to make on the behalf of another person. It's not an easy thing to talk through. And I think we need to probably develop different sort of metrics for how we choose these therapies and under what circumstances we use them. But it's a very difficult question to answer.
Lack of transparency, another issue, et cetera. We don't have to talk too much about it right now. We've got to talk about other cool drugs and how cool they are.
So we're going to talk about psoriasis, a morbid condition that we know also impacts the quality of life. And this is an original article out of the New England Journal of Medicine. A trial of roflumilast cream for chronic plaque psoriasis. The authors are just chock-a-block full of heavy hitters, starting off with Mark Liebwahl and including a whole bunch of luminaries in our field. The corresponding author is Howard Welgus. And this was done at multiple different centers across the United States. And they wanted to look at this roflumilast cream, which is a topical phosphodiesterase 4 inhibitor. So this is being investigated for the topical treatment of psoriasis. This was a phase 2B double-blinded trial. These were adults that were randomly assigned to roflumilast 0.3% cream, roflumilast 0.15% cream, or vehicle in a 1-to-1-to-1 ratio. And these adults all had plaque psoriasis. The application was once daily for 12 weeks, and they were looking at the investigator's global assessment of clear or almost clear at week 6. They used a 5-point scale of plaque thickening, scaling, and erythema. A score of 0 indicates clear, 1 almost clear, and it goes all the way up to 4, which is severe. Their secondary outcomes included a IGA score of clear or almost clear plus a 2-grade improvement in the IGA for the intertriginous area. So just like the oral PDE4 inhibitors have sort of a niche in the intertriginous psoriasis, it appears so too might topical PDE4 inhibitors. So they looked specifically at the intertriginous area and the POSI score as well. So they had 331 patients that they were able to randomize, about 100 patients and change per group. The IGA score indicating clear or almost clear was seen in 28% of patients on the higher percentage roflumilast cream, so the 0.3%, so 28% in 0.3% group, 23% in 0.15% group, and 8% in the vehicle group. They also looked specifically at intertriginous psoriasis and the investigator's global analysis of improvement in that specific area. And they found 73% improvement in patients on the roflumilast 0.3% and 29% on the vehicle group. So 73-29 for the vehicle. That's a pretty significant improvement, with the lower dose cream sort of in the middle at 44% IGA improvement in intertriginous psoriasis specifically. And then they also looked at the POSI scores, and they found the mean change from the baseline POSIs, which ranged from 7.6 to 7.8. The mean change was around -50% for the highest percentage cream, -49%, so not a huge difference in the middle percentage cream, and then -17.8% in the vehicle. So that's just a decrease in the POSI score, which indicates improvement. So their conclusions from this study were that the once daily roflumilast cream was superior to vehicle and led to a state of clear or almost clear in 6 weeks in a significant proportion of patients. So let's talk about these medications and how they work. First of all, before this article was published, before kind of this time frame, there haven't been a whole lot of kind of topicals that are out of the axes that we're used to working on. So we're used to working with calcineurin inhibitors. We're used to working with vitamin D analogs. We're used to working with glucocorticoids. This is a topical that's a psoriasis medication that's not one of those things, or vitamin A analog. So it's, I think, interesting from that standpoint. The phosphodiesterase 4 is an enzyme that helps maintain the intracellular levels of cyclic AMP. And that mediates biologic response to extracellular stimuli, especially for immune cells. PDE4 activity we know is greater in psoriatic skin than healthy skin, and inhibition of PDE4 causes downregulation of immune modulators, including TNF-alpha, interferon gamma, interleukin-17, interleukin-23. So all of those pro-inflammatory cytokines have decreased production when you inhibit PDE4. Kind of a simplified way to think about it is an extracellular signal that means that the immune system has to do something, gears the cell up to do that by putting extra CMP in the cytoplasm, CAMP in the cytoplasm. And then that sort of starts the elaboration of other cytokines that have downstream effects. So we know we're familiar with apremilast as an oral PDE4 inhibitor that is used for moderate to severe plaque psoriasis. Crisaborole is a topical treatment for atopic dermatitis. They're looking at now topical PDE4 for psoriasis. Interestingly, apremilast, and you can probably notice a similarity, roflumilast, the milast sort of post-fix, I guess, has to do with a PDE4 inhibitor. Crisaborole is not named milast at the end. They kind of named that one after the boron ion that's at the center of the molecule.
But it should be crisaborimilast or something.
I mean, for consistency's sake, I would like that, but you know, we don't get to name these things, Luke, so... We just have to.
They would have such cool names if we did, though. Can you imagine?
They would all have superhero origin stories, and some of them would have, you know, like secret identities, especially if you could use them off label for different things. It would be really fun. But I think that the kind of key points that came out of this are that this is a good medication for intertriginous areas. And a lot of the other options that we have are not good options for intertriginous areas. So higher potency glucocorticoids, we don't want to use in those areas. Vitamin D analogs can be irritating, as can vitamin A analogs in those areas. So calcipotriene inhibitors can also have sort of an irritation response when you apply them to these intertriginous areas. So having a different topical for the specific areas, I think, is valuable. Their PASI reduction for the highest percentage cream was 31%, PASI 75. So 31% of their patients with the topical cream in monotherapy achieved PASI 75. And that's close to the PASI 75 you see with like clobetasol foam. So clobetasol foam, which you probably would not use in intertriginous areas, at least not for any significant period of time, at 4 weeks had a PASI 75 of 41% in a well-done study versus here the 31% PASI at 8 weeks for the roflumilast cream. So that is something to consider. Now, in terms of adverse events, they had some serious adverse events, none of which were thought to be related to the medication. They were all relatively scary ones, so I'm grateful that they did not seem to be associated with the medication. Then they also, of course, had some irritation of the skin, but it was not significant for most patients. So they had adverse events in 39% of patients at the 0.3% cream, 27% of those with the 0.15% cream, and 30% of those with the vehicle. 97% of the side effects were mild or moderate. The four serious effects that they thought were not related to the medication were chest pain, myocardial infarction, in a patient that had a history of myocardial infarction, melanoma that was not in the treatment area where roflumilast cream was applied, acute infarction of the left basal ganglia, but in the vehicle group, thank goodness, and not thank goodness that that happened to that person, but like mechanistically, it's nice to know that it was just something that happened to somebody putting a cream on their skin and not probably related to a medication.
And no then, creams for anybody.
And then spontaneous miscarriage, which is very sad, which also was in the vehicle group. The other reason I said it's kind of a good thing it was in the vehicle group was I often think about patients blaming themselves for bad things that happened to them. And, you know, in this circumstance, the miscarriage and the basal ganglia couldn't have been related to just putting a cream on their skin so the patient doesn't have to be like, if I hadn't been in that trial, you know. So that made me feel happier for the patient and for the investigators that that was in the vehicle group, but of course sad that it happened at all. So the other thing that I wanted to point out is that the topical application site reactions were lower than you might expect based off of things that we use for atopic derm, like crisaborole, that are sort of in a similar family. And that might have to do with the fact that the baseline for skin pain is elevated in atopic dermatitis patients. About 42.7% of them experienced skin pain in the past week in a study just with normal day-to-day living. So skin site application discomfort might be something that will be less common with the use for topicals for psoriasis. Psychiatric comorbidities and nausea and vomiting, which would be things we'd worry about with something in the PDE4 family based off of the studies in the oral medications, did not show any difference between vehicle and either percentage cream. So no increase in nausea or vomiting, no increase in psychiatric symptoms, which is something that the package is, of course, labeled for. So we need to, for apremilast. So we need to think about apremilast being associated with those potentials for psychiatric comorbidity. Of course, it wasn't a huge signal. It was 1% in patients on drug versus 0.8% in placebo in the study, but still enough that it has a labeling indication for that. Another interesting thing was that they did notice improvement as early as 2 weeks for both roflumilast dose levels. So it operated relatively quickly. And they found also that they had a reasonable reaction with the PASI 75 that was comparable to other topicals available for psoriasis. So I thought it was a well-done study. It gives another therapeutic option, especially for difficult-to-treat areas. Of course, we want to think about the cost. So you nicely looked that up, Luke. So why don't you deliver that?
It's $800 for a 60-gram tube. And since we have been anchored on $2,000 for the ruxolitinib and $5,000 for baricitinib, $800 almost looks reasonable. But it's not. Don't be fooled. Don't be fooled by the anchors. It is not reasonable to spend $800 for 60 grams of a medicine that apparently works about as well as the other stuff we have. It's been hard for me to figure out where this might have a home. The intertriginous thing seems the most likely. If you can save somebody, you know, having to be put on an even more expensive biologic or something by treating their intertriginous psoriasis with Zorive, which is the brand name, then perhaps that's worth it. Otherwise, I'm almost surprised that people are still doing trials for topicals for psoriasis. I'm not a psoriasis expert, but psoriasis actually seems like we got a ton of great options now.
I know we do have a lot of different options. I think it might also have something to do with like patient preference. A lot of people still are not comfortable with the injectable biologics because they just do seem so serious, even though the newer class of them is so much safer and easier to use. When I first saw the name, I thought it was going to be like Russian for some reason. So I was saying it in my mind as Zorivye. I don't know why.
Maybe that's how you pronounce it.
It sounds like psoriasis a little bit if you say it that way, like Zorivye. I don't know, but it's probably not that. It's probably Zorive or something like that. But I think it's a mechanistic, it's mechanistically interesting how the PDE4 inhibitors work. And I do like having better understanding of how some of the inflammatory pathways get mucked up in these inflammatory skin conditions. Lots of nice pimpable content and a new medication option.
I have to admit I wasn't expecting much from it because I don't like the other PDE4 inhibitors that exist. I don't think apremilast works well for psoriasis. I don't think chrysoboral works well at all for eczema. So maybe this intertriginous thing is where roflumilast might have a home.
I like apremilast for patients that need something systemic and aren't comfortable with an injection. I think that there is a subset of patients that works well for patients who have more acryloid scalp or intertriginous disease. But, you know, with all of these medications, it is hard to stack up against things like Cosentyx and Taltz and stuff that just have such strong posies and such relatively gentle side effect profiles. So, you know, I agree with you that in some ways, if we took the patient preference portion of the equation out of the picture, these medicines might not be as necessary, but I think patient comfort with therapeutics is one of those central issues that we always have to work through and around, and having options is a good thing. But I agree with you, we do need to be thoughtful stewards of healthcare dollars.
Well, speaking of other, I was about to say unnecessary psoriasis creams, but I'll withhold myself from saying that. Speaking of other topical psoriasis medications that have been recently approved and sound vaguely Russian, I want to talk about Tapinarof.
It's so, like the brothers Karamazov. Tapinarof, Karamazov, and Zorivye.
This is the last medicine to be approved that we're going to talk about today. So again, out of the New England Journal, phase 3 trials of Tapinarof cream for plaque psoriasis. Authors include Mark Lebwohl, Linda Steingold, Robert Bissonnette. And one of the authors is also April Armstrong, who we heart on this podcast. So I thought
we heart April Armstrong. Absolutely.
So this is an interesting one because it's a novel mechanism of action. So it is a topical aryl hydrocarbon receptor agonist.
This one's fascinating to me.
We talked a little bit about the aryl hydrocarbon receptor once upon a time, and we talked about an article on like wildfire pollution potentially increasing patients' skin disease and pruritus, and potentially some of those aerosolized molecules from the fires impacted this aryl, A-R-Y-L, hydrocarbon receptor in human skin. And this is a drug that is an agonist for the aryl hydrocarbon receptor. So through some fairly complicated mechanism, this ends up affecting interleukin 17, which we know is involved in the pathogenesis of psoriasis, as well as filaggrin and loricrin, which are two proteins that help create the skin barrier. So this was two phase three trials, 1,025 adults with moderate to severe psoriasis. Their total body surface area affected was 3 to 20%. They were randomized to tapinarof, or vehicle, in a 2-to-1 fashion, once daily for 12 weeks. And the goal was to be clear or almost clear through not the PASI, which we might be used to, but the PGA score. So the Professional Golfers Association was helping out with the trial.
Well, we got hotels and golf and all sorts of things happening today.
And the goal was reached by 38% of people in the tapinarof group. Once again, the goal was clear, almost clear. So 38% in the tapinarof group and only 6% in the vehicle group. They did report some PASI numbers as well. So PASI 75 at week 12 was reached by 40% in the treatment group and 8% in the placebo group. And PASI 90, yeah, usually I see that only for like biologics and stuff, was reached by 20% in the treatment group and 3% in the vehicle group.
That's pretty good.
So story seems to work all right. Again, whether or not it's more effective than other things we have is going to be a little bit tough to prove, I would say. The adverse effects were mild, as you might expect, but there. Adverse effects of some kind or another were experienced by 50% of people in the tapinarof group and 25% of people in the placebo group. This included folliculitis, which was experienced by a fifth of people in the tapinarof group, 20%, quite a bit, including one, quote, severe version of folliculitis. About 5% of people in the tapinarof group had contact dermatitis. About 4% had headache. It's kind of weird.
Yeah, it is weird.
Does it get into your blood and get up into your head and give you headache?
That's a good question.
What about that one? This thing is called Vtama, if you wanted to buy it and pronounce the brand name, V-T-A-M-A, $1,200 for 60 grams. And then one more note about the aryl hydrocarbon receptor, which is of interest from a basic science standpoint. It's a transcription factor. It's got roles in the regulation of cytokine and skin barrier protein expression and also antioxidant activities. So taken together, they say the mechanism of action of tapinarof involves immune modulation, skin barrier normalization, and antioxidant activity.
I actually think that aryl hydrocarbon receptor inhibition probably has some place in the anti-aging industry as well. There's actually natural inhibitors of the aryl hydrocarbon receptor, including resveratrol. So I wonder if that modification or modulation might not be something that's on the advancing edge of the sort of anti-aging industry.
Well, again, with tapinarof, sort of like roflumilast, I'm left kind of wondering what its role is going to be, which patients we'll use it for. It's always kind of nice to have something else out there. I guess I've already said my piece on this. Anything else you want to bring out, Michelle?
Let's see, I'm going to try to do this properly, but whenever I tell my residents to learn all these new topicals for psoriasis and they ask me why, I'll say, Patamushka yaskasala, because that means because I said so in Russian. So,
perfect. All right. Well, thank you very much for joining us, comrades and listeners. Today, we learned about flow cytometry with Dr. Vermeer. And then we learned about the trials that led to the approvals of various dermatologic medications, including ruxolitinib cream for vitiligo. Thanks, Dr. Nicole Ufkis, for joining us for that one. Baricitinib for alopecia areata, roflumilast cream for psoriasis, and tapinarof cream for psoriasis as well. If you would like to hear more of our episodes, you can do so on our website, dermospherepodcast.com. It has our entire archive, as well as links to all of the original articles, and is a good way to get in touch with us. You can also find us on social media, and thanks to Morgan Dykeman, med student and member of Team Dermosphere, who keeps our social media accounts humming. You can find us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. That's the other one. You can also find us on our other podcast.
Our other podcast is called Skincast. It is directed at the lay public. The episodes are about 15 to 20 minutes long and generally cover one or two topics. And you can find those at the University of Utah's website. They are a little bit more like digestible, but we also try to keep them fun and lighthearted and informative.
And if you really want to see more of us, maybe get us to sign your forehead or something, Michelle and I are speaking at a couple meetings that are coming up. So, Michelle, you and I are going to both be at Texas Derm Society.
Yes, the Texas Derm Society meeting in Bastrop, Texas, which is near Austin and very lovely. So we're looking forward to that, talking about different elements of dermatology. I'll be focusing on dermoscopy and some advances in dermatology. And what are you going to be talking about, Luke?
Well, I figure as a speaker, if I have any kind of competitive advantage, it's this stuff that I learned from doing the podcast. So we usually talk about updates from the literature. So if you're a Dermosphere aficionado and you already know all this stuff, then maybe it won't be all that helpful. But still would love to see you there in Bastrop, Texas. That's September 23rd and 24th for the Texas Derm Society meeting. And then every year, I am the course director for the Practical Dermatology for Primary Care course here at the University of Utah. We're going to do a hybrid event this year. So if you can make it out to Salt Lake City on Friday, October 7th, we'd love to see you there. If you can't make it out, but you still want to participate, you can do it virtually as well. This is Practical Dermatology for Primary Care. So our target audience is primary care providers, but of course, dermatologists and other folks are more than welcome to attend. If you would like to, you can Google University of Utah Practical Dermatology for Primary Care, and then I will also put a link in the show notes. That's all for now, everybody. We will see you next time.